macromedia.org.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Smallpox is getting some big attention these days. The life-threatening disease was consigned to the annals of medical history in the 1970s, but lived on in the medical labs in the United States and the former Soviet Union. Nobody worried too much about those stocks until bioterrorism became a post-9/11 preoccupation. The possibility that terrorists might have smuggled the smallpox virus out of Russia and into, say, Iraq or North Korea have heightened fears of the virus as a bioweapon. Smallpox is an easily transmittable airborne virus. One infected East Coaster hops a plane to the West Coast, coughs in a couple of crowded airport terminals, and the conditions are ripe for an epidemic. So when Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson announced that, contrary to what was previously thought, there is enough smallpox vaccine for the entire U.S. population, the clamor began for preemptive, voluntary vaccinations. But here's the catch. There is no evidence of a terrorist's plans for smallpox as weapon, and the vaccine itself poses health risks of its own. Connection listeners, would you get the shot? Should the CDC allow voluntary vaccinations, or is it premature and even foolhardy to inoculate a large, healthy population with a potentially deadly virus? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We are at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined on the program by Dr. Bill Bicknell. He is Professor of International Health at Boston University's School of Public Health, and Dr. Jonathan Tucker, Director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Jonathan's also author of Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. So, Jonathan, I'll start with you because I really think we need to begin with an understanding of just how real this threat is.
Well, the dilemma is we don't know exactly how real it is. There is circumstantial evidence that outside of the two official repositories of the smallpox virus that have been authorized by the World Health Organization for research purposes, countries may have retained illicit or undeclared stocks of the virus. And there is circumstantial evidence in the public domain that Iraq and North Korea and perhaps Russia as well may have undeclared stocks. There is no evidence that the virus has fallen into the hands of terrorists, and it's unclear why, even if these states did possess the virus, why they would it would be in their interest to provide them to terrorists.
And specifically, why is it that when we talk about bioterrorism, we end up talking about smallpox? I mean, it could be swine flu, it could be the plague, it could be Ebola. I mean, I think we need to be a little bit careful about scaring people, but we also need to address what's out there.
Well, smallpox is a potential biological warfare agent. It was developed as a biological weapon by the Soviet Union on a very large scale. They had produced, from what we know from defectors, ton quantities of the smallpox virus in a liquid suspension. They developed sophisticated delivery systems, including intercontinental ballistic missile warheads that were designed to deliver smallpox against U.S. cities in the event of World War III. So we know that smallpox has been developed as a weapon in the past. It has a number of characteristics that would make it a potential terrorist weapon. It is contagious from person to person so that a small-scale release could trigger a major outbreak. It is very robust. It could survive in the air for a period of hours so that if it were released as an aerosol, as a fine suspension of particles, it could be inhaled by a large number of people to cause an epidemic. On the other hand, because it is a contagious agent, it is not targetable. Anthrax, for example, when released, will be just affect the exposed population. But with a disease like smallpox, there is potential for a boomerang effect so that the attacker might want to target the United States, but ultimately the disease could spread from country to country and ultimately threaten the very population on whose behalf the terrorists claim to be acting.
Okay, let me turn.
It has both strengths and weaknesses as a terrorist weapon.
Let me turn to Bill Bicknell here, because the last known case in the United States was, what, 1949, over 50 years ago.
A long while ago.
And given the sort of information that Jonathan has just told us about the possibility of a threat, you have the Center for Disease Control saying, no need to do anything. Doctors like yourself saying, you know what? Maybe we should allow people to get voluntary vaccinations. Why would you take a stand like that?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons to seriously consider and publicly debate the voluntary pre-exposure approach. I think Dr. Tucker is completely right. We don't know for sure it's spread, but an awful lot of people seem to think that it is outside of just the two laboratories in the Soviet Union and CDC. And that probability, the probability of use as a weapon, none of us can assign a value to. And that's difficult. What was the probability of 9/11 on 9/10? It's hard to put a number on that. It's greater than zero. One part of my position is individuals should make that particular assessment for themselves. If they think it's a very, very low or no risk issue, don't opt for the vaccine. If you do, opt for it. But what has to be done to allow individuals to essentially control their own choices, make their own choices in those situations? I think we have to look at the CDC approach as I understand it. And the CDC approach is evolving and changing, and they do say that very clearly in their guidelines.
Well, let's just talk about the approach, because they're suggesting that some kind of containment after infection is still the best policy, given the fact that there are some fairly serious side effects from the vaccine. Why is it that if smallpox were to pop up in some place in the United States, that the idea of containment is to you no longer a useful way of fighting something like smallpox?
Well, I think if we had one exposure, non-malicious, like a laboratory accident, that would be the way to go. Ring containment was used to eradicate smallpox over a long period of time.
Ring containment means literally putting a ring around the
infected area? Absolutely. You find and you vaccinate around the ring and around the ring. And the problem with that approach, and you link to quarantine, there are several problems with it. I think we have to assume a malicious exposure, and that it might be 5 or 10 terrorists traveling to a multiple number of cities where there'd be many, many infected people. That is going to make ring containment very difficult. Identifying where the terrorist went and who was who he came in or she came in contact with will be, I think, close to impossible until you have disease popping up all over the place. The risk of panic is very, very substantial. Administering tens of millions of doses in days is highly problematic. There is the CDC guidelines stated it would be good to recognize within a 4-day window where vaccine after exposure may prevent or make the disease less severe.
Let me turn to Dr. Tucker if I can, because Dr. Tucker, you're not in favor of the sort of voluntary vaccination that Dr. Bicknell's talking about here. Is it because of the side effects of the vaccine?
Yes. I mean, if this was an absolutely harmless vaccine, vaccinating the population would be a no-brainer. It would be a reasonable precaution. But because this vaccine, which I should clarify, is not smallpox itself, but a related virus that normally is fairly benign but can produce significant complications in a subset of the population, either because they're immunosuppressed or they have other risk factors. You know, if it were a perfectly safe vaccine, then I would be a strong advocate of prophylactic vaccination. But because that is not the case, And the current vaccine, we know from experience back in the 60s, produced significant levels of death, permanent injury, and other complications. Until we have a better sense that this is an imminent threat, until we have better intelligence or better evidence that the virus actually has fallen into the hands of terrorists, I think it would be reckless for us to vaccinate a significant portion of the population, because we would be basically telling people to enter into a significant risk for a very questionable benefit.
Bill?
Well, let me just address that. And first, I'd like to say I think there are three significant major advantages to consider when you think of pre-exposure vaccination. It decreases the weapons value of smallpox.
Well, that's only if everybody takes
the more people take it, the less the value. And the more people take it, the easier it is to control if it is used, because instead of having X million, you have a fraction of X million people. Second, the risks of the vaccine need to be placed in perspective. We routinely gave it to everybody, avoiding infants in certain critical groups, up until the late 60s, very early 70s. There are more immunocompromised people today, whether it's HIV/AIDS, organ transplants, cancer.
Immunocompromised people are people who should not be getting this vaccine?
Yes. Most would think absolutely should not. Yeah.
Right.
And AIDS, HIV,
right.
Organ transplants, people who have had a kidney transplant and are getting a drug so they don't reject the kidney, they wouldn't want to get it because the vaccine may spread and cause real damage to them. Now, those people in a non-crisis situation can be identified, segregated, and protected. In a crisis situation, the people at greatest risk of vaccine complications and of smallpox are the immunocompromised. So it's really, I think, substantially in their interest to have as many people vaccinated before exposure as possible. Also, to the extent we decrease the weapons value in the eyes of a terrorist, we provide secondary protection to other countries, because less likely to attack here, less likely there'll be leakage and secondary spread.
Let me just get Dr. Tucker to speak to this idea that you know, we, the United States, at one point was quite willing to accept the risks from giving the vaccine to a wide variety of people. What's changed today, Dr. Tucker?
Well, what's changed is that the natural disease no longer exists. And when people were at significant risk of being exposed to natural smallpox, which existed in the world and could have been easily imported into the United States, then it made sense to vaccinate the population and to make sure we had a significant level of what's called herd immunity, that is, immunity throughout the population. But today, we don't know that there is the natural disease hasn't existed for 25 years. The last case in the world was in 1978. And we just don't know that smallpox continues to pose a significant threat to the average American. And given that lack of assessed risk, I think to ask people to subject themselves to a significant risk of complications in order to protect themselves against an event that may never occur, I think is unwise.
All right,
and
I'm going to interrupt
there are
you
ways
here
of addressing
we have
this,
to
this
step
threat.
Away for a break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're talking about smallpox, the fact that we know that there is enough vaccine in the country, and arguing about whether or not people should be allowed to get a vaccination for smallpox if they want to. Right now, the CDC says that's not necessary. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
5 degrees in Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, we're talking about smallpox, the possible use of the virus as a bioweapon, and what the appropriate response would be under the circumstances, or even in consideration of it as a possible threat. I should note that the upcoming edition of the New England Journal of Medicine is dealing with this in some considerable depth. And if you'd like to see what they have online about that, you can either go direct to nejm.org, that's the New England Journal of Medicine's website, or you can find a link to them on our website. We're at theconnection.org. Once again, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Dr. Jonathan Tucker. He's director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Washington. And he's written a book. It's called Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. With me in the studio is Dr. Bill Bicknell. He is professor of international health at Boston University's School of Public Health. We're going to go first to Greensboro, North Carolina, and have Fulari join the program. Hi, Fulari.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I just like to make a comment concerning the topic at hand, because while I was growing up in Nigeria, there were several cases of children, you know, who had the disease, and it was quite dreadful. And I believe it should be something that it shouldn't be of involuntary. It should be voluntary, that people should be made, you know, to be vaccinated.
You're saying people should have the choice because you've seen what the disease can do.
That's right.
Even though, at this point, it's still very unclear what the threat is.
Yeah, that's right. And, you see, the reason why I would advocate for voluntary is because, you know, people should have the choice of being vaccinated, because once they are ignorant of the fact that this disease is quite dreadful, you know, they might, you know, try to, you know, pave way for the disease. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, Fulari, thank you very much for your call.
All right.
Dr. Bicknell, this idea of the side effects, I really do want to try and get a clearer sense of this, because, you know, when I look at statistics that say a vaccination of the entire American population of 280 million people could result in as many as 1,000 deaths and tens of thousands of serious health, serious health complications. I know we're not talking about a nationwide vaccination, but we are talking about some fairly substantial risks,
well,
are we not?
I think the numbers that that I quoted and used for a nationwide program would be around 180 deaths. And that's about the number of people who die every day and a half in an auto accident. The risk is about the risk of driving to work every morning. It's not a high risk. But let's look at it. The last time there was vaccination on any big scale in the U.S. was in the late 60s. A little over 14 million people were vaccinated. 16 people died, a little more in the unvaccinated, a little less, lower rate in those who had a prior vaccination, about 1 per million overall. And there were, of those 14-plus million, there were 30, 35 serious complications, including the 16 deaths, really serious complications, another, you know, perhaps 100, real uncomfortable but not lethal, and you get over it complications, and the rest are far more minor. This is a risk that was routinely taken and accepted by the American public when there hadn't been smallpox for years and years.
But Dr. Tucker's making the point that the disease as we know it is wiped out, that really all we're doing is vaccinating for the possibility of a threat.
That's why that is a decision, I think, that is not one that should be left to government. That's why it should be voluntary, and individuals should be able to say, I assess the risk more. I've seen it as a child in Nigeria. I've read this and that and opt for it. I have a colleague who says, I think the risk is low. I'd never do it. Fine. Let individuals make that decision.
Okay, Dr. Tucker, when I read about the old stocks of vaccine that are put away, I also read that the circumstances under which they were collected may not have been as hygiene as the standards which we would expect today. So if the vaccine that has sort of miraculously reappeared last week were to be diluted and distributed, would there be further risks from in comparison to the sort of vaccine that would be produced today?
There may be a greater risk with the old vaccine. That was the vaccine that was, in fact, used to eradicate smallpox. We know it's highly effective, but it was produced in a very crude method, basically it involved scratching the skin of calves, inoculating the vaccinia, the vaccine virus, waiting a week for pustules to form, and then harvesting the pustules. And basically, you had cow pus that was filtered to remove large particles and hairs and then freeze-dried as the vaccine. So it was a very crude preparation, but it worked. It did the job. Today, that would be totally unacceptable by the Food and Drug Administration as a licensed vaccine. So the same vaccine virus will be used, but it will be grown in tissue culture, which is a sterile culture media. So we will have the same vaccine virus, but without the likely contaminants of the old vaccine, which probably has other types of bacteria and viruses contaminating it. But the question is, the main risk associated with the vaccine is probably the fact that it is a live virus vaccine. And in people who have an impaired immune system, the vaccine virus, which is benign and normally in healthy people, can replicate out of control and cause systemic illness.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Arlington, Massachusetts. Debbie's calling in. Hi, Debbie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that the vaccine, my understanding is the vaccine that we have the stockpile of now is not a licensed product by the FDA. Is that correct?
My understanding is that it was licensed under all the appropriate authorities at the time it was being used, and the license has expired. I'm not an expert in this area, and it would have to be relicensed. I think that's an accomplishable thing.
Dr. Tucker, do you know the?
Yes, the what's called the Dryvax vaccine produced by Wyeth, this was the freeze-dried form of the calf lymph vaccine, was taken off the market in 1983 after the World Health Organization declared that smallpox had been eradicated worldwide. So it has not been available to the public since 1983.
Okay, Debbie, was that a preface to a question?
I guess so. So if that's the vaccine that we're talking about, and it's the same calf serum sort of not really sterilely formed vaccine that Dr. Tucker was just suggesting that we have in the future, it definitely seems questionable to offer it to the wider public, given that there haven't been any long-term tests done on it. Certainly a new vaccine, there's not really time to do long-term testing to look at how does it impact people's overall health over time.
So how do you judge it, Debbie? I mean, basically what we're talking about is whatever we've been able to figure out about this threat of bioterrorism, and then your decision, your option mm-hmm. as a citizen to say, you know what, I think I'll pass, or I think I'll get the vaccine.
Right. I think that certainly in the midst of a crisis, my decision would have to be made, as opposed to right now when we're not facing one. But at this point, I think that not knowing the long-term impact of the vaccine, not knowing what the complications could be, I probably would opt out.
Say no thanks.
Yes.
Yes. I think we do know what the complications would be quite well, and that's the data I cited. I would also not want to leave listeners thinking this is an unsterile vaccine made, you know, contaminated with cow pus. I think that overstates somewhat or leaves leaves the viewer thinking this is something out of the Middle Ages. This is a product with some side effects. And the side effects, there are a small number of very serious ones and a larger number of not so serious ones. So a very reasonable approach would be the following. And I would point out that CDC has chosen to, with the, quote, old existing vaccine, has immunized its own flying squads of investigators.
Okay, Debbie, thank you for your call.
Thank you very much.
We're going to Steve now, who's waiting on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
What do you think? Would you get the shot?
Oh, absolutely. And
because you want to make the call, you don't want someone at the CDC making the call?
I would think I really like the idea of a voluntary system. And I also I also would like to ask a question, and that is, what are the risk factors? If we understand them well enough, why don't we allow the people who aren't in possession of any of those risk factors go ahead and voluntarily elect to take the vaccine? And then I have a comment, too.
Okay, let me Dr. Tucker in on your question, and then back to you.
There are a number of risk factors associated with serious complications. One would be an impaired immune system. For example, someone with HIV/AIDS would be at significant risk of complications.
Okay, Steve's saying if someone's completely healthy and wants to make the
problem was that a certain number of children who developed vaccinal encephalitis, which was one of the serious complications, had no known risk factors before they were vaccinated. And even today, it's not fully understood why they developed serious complication, this particular complication.
What is it that you just described, vaccinal encephalitis? What's
it's
that?
Called a vaccinal encephalitis, which was an inflammation of the brain that could cause death or permanent brain damage in some cases, in about 25 to 30% of cases. And the dilemma with post-vaccinal encephalitis was that in some cases there was not a clear risk factor before the child was vaccinated that could have led one to predict the likelihood of complications.
Dr. Bicknell.
Well, let's put that in perspective.
I need you to face the microphone. Here
there were 16 cases of post-vaccinal encephalitis. There were four deaths in 14 million people. If, for example, we said, let's not immunize children under four, that those numbers would drop to the vanishing point and would but let's immunize the parents. And if in the case of an attack, it's rather easy to isolate young children. So I think there are real ways around that.
Isn't there already precedent for having someone's doctor make the decision that yes, you are, or yes, you are not healthy enough to get this vaccine, whether it's a travel vaccine or something like that? Doesn't that exist now with
I think with proper kind of updating the education of docs and the general public, I think safe, sound decisions can be made on an individual basis in a non-crisis environment, which protects the immunocompromised far, far better than vaccinating in a moment of crisis.
Steve, back to you.
Yeah, I thought that last comment was very well put. And I think that did address the question. I really do think that there would be a way of selectively allowing voluntary vaccination. Now, the comment that I had was that I've done some studying on this, and I believe that, and I'll use some recent history as an indicator of how difficult it was to deal with the anthrax outbreak that we had, I think it's really rather unlikely that we could imagine that a multiple site outbreak of an airborne virus that can be transmitted from person to person, that we would be able to deal with it effectively so as to contain it and not cause hundreds of thousands of deaths, if not more.
Don't you think, though, Steve, that there comes a point where you have to draw the line and say, these are the seven or eight possible bioterrorist weapons that the bad guys could use. These are all the different chemicals that we need to immunize or protect ourselves with. I mean, at some point we walk around like we're full of serum and carrying a gas mask wherever we go.
Well, I'm not saying that we ought to all go panic. But I'm saying that we need to be prepared, and it is the government's responsibility to make sure that the most number of people will survive an attack, which I think will probably some idiot will try, you know? I mean, maybe not an idiot. I shouldn't say that. It could be somebody who just happens to be...
You can be crazy like a fox. No, I hear
crazy,
you.
Crazy, yeah. But,
Steve, I'm going to move on, if you don't mind. Thank you for your call.
Okay, sure.
We're going to Wake Forest, North Carolina. Laura's joining us. Hi, Laura.
Hello. I have a comment to make. Sometimes I think it's important to not only
listen to what the government says, but to see what they're doing. When I was in the military in 1989, all of us were vaccinated against smallpox. And my health department here, they're very surprised by that because no one else had been vaccinated since the early 70s. Do you know, is the military still vaccinating the soldiers?
I think they stopped in 1990.
Either 90 or 92, the military stopped vaccinating, but they did vaccinate until then, is my understanding.
How long does it last, the vaccination?
Five to 10 years, possibly longer.
Sorry, Laura, yeah. Go ahead.
I had another comment, too. Tetanus is voluntary right now, and it's not available anymore because some of the manufacturers stopped making it. And the concern is if it's voluntary but necessary when you actually need it, will there be enough? I know there is right now, but, I mean, more people die from tetanus this year than other diseases, and yet you can't get a tetanus shot.
Dr. Tucker?
Yes. The answer is that the smallpox vaccine is extremely stable. In fact, we now know that the Aventis vaccine that was produced in 1958 is still potent. So if it is stored under appropriate conditions, cold conditions, it is has an almost unlimited shelf life. So we don't need to continually produce a smallpox vaccine the way we would for polio vaccine or measles vaccine, other vaccines.
Now, Jonathan, what about the point that Laura made that we should look at not what the government says but what it does and the fact that they were vaccinating soldiers much later than they were vaccinating other civilians?
Well, that is a somewhat different situation where troops might have been sent into a war battle situation in which there was a potential threat of use of smallpox as a biological weapon. That is different. That would be state-level use. That is different from the possibility that terrorists would get their hands on it and use it against American civilian population. And also, the military did stop vaccinating for a number of reasons. One, they ran short of what's called vaccinia immune globulin, which is an antidote that can be given in some cases to treat some of the complications of the vaccine. And also, they encountered problems with vaccination. The fact that this is a live virus vaccine means that someone who has been vaccinated can actually spread the vaccine virus to other people, including people who are susceptible to complications. So that you had a situation in which soldiers who had been vaccinated had to be more or less quarantined for a couple of weeks until the inoculation site scabbed over so that they wouldn't spread the vaccine to other susceptible individuals.
All right. I have to interrupt you there.
There are significant logistical problems associated with vaccination.
Laura, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the availability of smallpox vaccine, asking you if the government were to say it's up to you, would you get the shot? Would you take the advice of the Center for Disease Control, which at this point is saying, don't get the shot, we'll deal with an infection if one were to occur. Once again, our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
909-9287.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. We're talking about getting vaccinated for smallpox, whether or not it's something that should be left up to the individual, should be left up to the federal government, should be left up to the doctor or the state, or whether or not the vaccination is even necessary at all, given the fact that the disease has been eradicated in the United States, although the bioterror threat may be there. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Boston, and Madeline's joining us. Hi, Madeline.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for having me on.
Yep.
I'm a science journalist in Boston. I just came out with a book titled Secret Agents, The Menace of Emerging Infections, which looks in part at bioterrorism. And I wanted to make a comment and ask a question. The comment is, I was in Atlanta last week for an international conference on emerging infections. And I asked a number of officials about what would be the threshold event that would persuade public health officials to vaccinate the entire U.S. population against smallpox.
I mean, what would it take?
What would it take? What would be the threshold?
And what did they tell you?
And there was no agreement among the various experts and officials that I asked. And I understand that this is a very tricky public health decision because, as the guests have mentioned, the risk of smallpox is unknown. We have a susceptible population, high rate of complications in the vaccine, a limited vaccine supply at least now, and this is an investigational new drug.
And you'll recall as well, Madeline, back in the mid-70s when Gerald Ford decided that the whole country should be vaccinated for swine flu, that whole thing fell apart because there were people raising questions about the efficacy of the vaccine and the danger of the vaccine, and surely the people in Atlanta are looking back at that debacle and wondering whether or not they would head in that direction as well.
You're right. There's a very compressed timeline right now for manufacturing this vaccine, and there is a worry, as with the swine flu vaccine, of whether there is going to be adequate time for testing this. Oh. My question is this. Is there a protocol by which officials will be making this decision, or will it be, as we saw a bit with the anthrax epidemic last year, a bit of a seat-of-the-pants decision, or is that almost inevitable that this decision about mass vaccination would have to be somewhat based on instinct?
Dr. Tucker, do you want to start with that?
Well, there is a protocol. The CDC has issued at least interim guidelines for what to state and local health officials for what to do. And if there were a suspected case of smallpox, based on symptomatology, the CDC would send in a team which would confirm the diagnosis, take samples back to the laboratory, and make sure that, in fact, this was smallpox and not probably a severe case of chickenpox. Once the case was confirmed, then vaccine would be airlifted to the site, and health officials would immediately begin. They would isolate the infected individuals and track down everyone with whom they came in contact in recent days, vaccinate them to create a kind of a firebreak of immune individuals to prevent the epidemic from spreading.
Jonathan,
this would be
sorry.
The targeted use of the vaccine, which could then be backed up with mass vaccination if necessary, but the first strategy would be targeted vaccination.
Jonathan, in Dr. Bicknell's writing, he talks about the fact that, you know, in the last 30 years, we have become so much more mobile, so much more likely to have someone who would be exposed, get on a plane, get off a plane, that the old containment description that you just went through might not work in 2002 because we're not talking about villages in Yugoslavia and places like that. Does that concern you?
Well, the so-called surveillance containment technique was used effectively in India, which was a highly mobile society, as well as Bangladesh. And these there were literally millions of people moving around the country at any given moment. And it involved a very large and organized system. They had to mobilize large numbers of health workers to identify outbreaks and vaccinate around them. Mm-hmm. It is doable, but it requires a good level of organization, requires training physicians to recognize the very early symptoms of smallpox and do a differential diagnosis from chickenpox. So we do need to improve our preparedness. There's no question about that. But I do believe it would be premature to vaccinate the entire country or at least make it available to the entire country.
Let me just make a couple of comments on that. The CDC documents, as I read them, they said, you know, if we have a small terrorist attack, we should be able to contain it within a year. I think this country can do do much better than that. I don't think India and Bangladesh in the 70s are comparable to the U.S. now. There was a high and growing level of immunity in the population there, and we were eradicating in a non-malicious context. I think this is a very, very different situation. My own preference would be to let's first protect the system that cares for all of us and immunize first responders, doctors, nurses, bus drivers, people who run the water supply and the like. Ask them to give blood so that we can then produce large amounts of what you mentioned, vaccinia immune globulin, VIG, a blood product that is effective for treating some but not all of the side effects vaccine. Then when we have those supplies in large quantity, and that's quite relatively easy to produce, make available the old, well-known vaccine, of which we now have millions of doses available, and let people opt for that. And then as the new vaccine is developed and tested, then make that available.
Madeline, I think you're hearing that there's not a lot of agreement here either.
Yes. Can I make just a couple comments?
Just one, if you wouldn't mind. We've got a number of other people I'd like to get on the program.
All right, sure. A smallpox epidemic in the United States, it sounds horrific to even say such a thing, today would not act like a naturally occurring sort of endemic disease in the countries that were last immunized in the 1970s. If, for example, there were 10 football stadiums on a Saturday that were exposed to smallpox virus through an aerosol, it would be almost impossible to do the kind of contact tracing that is an integral part of the ring vaccination strategy. And it seems in that case it would be public health officials would not be able to keep up with the epidemic, and unfortunately, some kind of mass vaccination program would have to be the backdrop. I just want to...
Madeline, last question then for you. You've been in Atlanta talking to the doctors, and you write about this. Would you get the shot if it was voluntary?
Probably not. Probably not, because of the issue that Jonathan Tucker brings up. The vaccinia is a live virus. It's not an individual decision. It's a societal issue. You can transmit vaccinia to susceptible people. I just want to leave with one question. If smallpox were released in London, or if it escaped, say, from a lab in North Korea, would the U.S. hoard its smallpox vaccine supply?
I don't understand your question.
My question is, the U.S. now is building a vaccine, a smallpox vaccine.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would they hoard the vaccine supply?
Would we hoard our own vaccine supply for ourselves? Would we release it to other countries?
Dr. Tucker, do you know if that's even been considered?
It has been considered, and now that we're producing such a large stockpile, I think we would be more likely to consider making it available to other countries, particularly friendly countries, if they came under attack or experienced an outbreak.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. Madeline, thanks for being with us. To Greenville, North Carolina. Irvin, you're next. Hi, Irvin.
Hello. Yes, a lot of debate is going on while we're determining whether the government or whether we ourselves should administer this dose to amongst ourselves. It would be a good idea, I would think, to get the doses available to the people in the regions where they could be needed. And whenever the decision's made, I would have my dose ready for me, registered in my name, so that I know I'm safely protected and in the sort of guaranteed accessibility, if you will. That would ease my mind a little bit.
Why would we choose to have all those doses in Greenville ready to go instead of Anchorage, Alaska? I'm not sure I'm with you here.
No, everywhere. It should be distributed pretty much everywhere, you know. I want my dose with my name on it locally so that I can go get it when I'm told to get it.
Your doctor, your hospital can give it to you that afternoon if the call goes out.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Irvin. Dr. Tucker, is that part of the protocol that's been talked about?
Well, it is consistent with the idea of targeted use. If there is an outbreak in Anchorage, you vaccinate people in Anchorage, not in South Carolina. And I think that makes sense because you really need to focus the vaccine in the threat area. The scenario that Dr. Bicknell raised of multiple releases in football stadiums, or maybe that was Madeline Drexler.
Right.
Drexler. That is a worst case scenario. I mean, the probability of that is extremely small. And I don't think we should base public policy on worst case scenarios.
Okay. First of all, I think worst case scenarios are an essential part of considering a public policy, and that is a bad case. It may not be a worst case scenario. 8 or 10 terrorists infected coming through multiple ports of entry, going through 4 or 5 cities before they get sick or are recognized, could be is a conceivable a scenario if you have a thoughtful, coordinated terrorist event. And let's look back to Yugoslavia. The index case in Yugoslavia did not have a rash and never appeared to have smallpox. It's not so easy to do this early diagnosis, rapid recognition, targeting, and ring containment. I think we have to get rid of the rose-colored glasses, look seriously at reality and what are the benefits of and costs and risks of pre-exposure versus the benefits and costs of post-exposure in a very emergent crisis-oriented environment.
In on this, Jonathan.
Okay. In the Yugoslav case, Dr. Bicknell in his article in New England Journal refers to a ratio of infected individuals to contacts of 1 to 38. And that was a very unusual case, a case of hemorrhagic smallpox, a very rare variant of smallpox, in which there is a considerable release of aerosolized virus. But in the vast majority of cases, there would be a much lower ratio of transmission.
Let me just say to Connection listeners that we're talking about a case that's discussed by Dr. Bicknell in the New England Journal of Medicine, which you can see online. I should just stop us here and because we're getting into territory that gets a little technical and ask whether each of you, whether or not, without going too far down the road towards Big Brother and Bill, I'll start with you here. You know, this is either an issue of homeland defense, where the government needs to make some decisions about protecting all its people, or it's a decision of individuals.
I believe it's both. I think, first, it should be made available to individuals with full knowledge so they can make their own assessment. And then when and if there is a terrorist attack and there needs to be further immunization,
then let the government make the decision.
Absolutely. Let's push it. Let's make it mandatory. I'm not, even then, it would be hard to do mandatory.
Door to door, street to street. Dr. Tucker, the is it both? Is it both an issue of homeland defense where the government has to look after the whole country, or is it a question of individual's choice?
I think it is. I think it's an issue of really national policy, because there are significant risks with the vaccine, not only to the individual, but also the potential for spread of the vaccine virus, so that vaccinated individuals can potentially spread the vaccine virus to susceptible individuals who could then develop complications. So it has to be done in a coordinated way. And given that the assessed threat today is very low, it does not make sense to expose the U.S. population to a known risk of vaccination against the really uncertain but apparently low risk of a bioterrorist use of this virus.
Well, you have both said in the past that it's important that we have a public debate on this, and I appreciate your taking the time to join us on the program. Bill Bicknell, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Jonathan Tucker, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Bicknell is professor of international health at Boston University School of Public Health. Dr. Tucker's with the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He's author of Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugarts. And Graham Smith is our senior producer. Tara Murphy is standing in for him today and doing an admirable job. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company.